Chapter 17, In the Prison. Meanwhile, Henry sat alone in the prison, for he had been confined in a separate room from Leonor, and had not been able to speak to her since their arrest. He intended to play the part which Leonor had assigned to him of her idiot page as long as possible, though he was not quite sure how she intended it to benefit either of them. It will easily be imagined that he felt very miserable. The trials of the last few weeks had done much to depress his naturally buoyant spirits, and thus he was more cast down by his present position than he would otherwise have been. He knew well enough now what an arrest meant for those who would not recant. At the mildest, it meant a covenant for the girl, a convent for the girl, the galleys for the boys. Beyond that, he did not care to think. He sat with his head on his hands, trying to realize what it would be, trying to school himself to face the only too probable fact that he should never see his brothers and sister again. The scalding tears forced themselves slowly between his fingers as he sat there, and he dashed them passionately away. Then he threw himself upon his knees, and spent his time in alternate prayers for help, and thanksgiving that Marie was not there and that Gollum had the packet safe. As for the testament, Marie had been carrying it at the time, so that too was safe. The day passed wearily away. Only once a gendarme came to him and brought some food, but mindful of his part, Henry did not speak a word to him. Toward evening, when it was getting dusk, he heard someone whistling beneath his window outside, and it did not look into the street but into a narrow passage at the back. He listened eagerly. It was the tune of the soldiers of the cross, and he knew it must be Gollum. The window was too high for him to see so near underneath it, but he waited for a pause and took up the tune himself. They answered each other in this way for some minutes, and then Gollum ceased, he supposed for fear of exciting suspicion. As night came on, and still no one appeared, he came to the conclusion that he was to spend it just where he was, and wondered anxiously what Leonor was doing. At length he fell into an uneasy slumber, and so the night passed, and another clear, beautiful morning dawned. It was still very early when he was taken out of his prison by two gendarmes, and he found a small body of them waiting outside, who had evidently been sent from the next town for the purpose of escorting the prisoners. Leonor was already in front, riding on a small horse, with a mounted gendarme on either side of her. And she did not look round at him, and he tried to appear as vacant and silly as possible. It was a great relief to him to find that the town to which they were bound was a stage further on their way to Bordeaux. He could scarcely have explained why, as he had not the slightest hope of release, but he liked to think that they were still going on. Besides, he knew that Gollum and Marie would be sure to have found out where they were going and would follow them as long as possible. It was late in the afternoon when they reached Marmondy, and they were kept waiting for some minutes in the broiling sun while one of the men waited on the council for orders. Finally, they were taken to the common prison, but still were confined separately and alone, and informed that they would go before the magistrate on the morrow. Henry received the news with indifference. He was so far exhausted by this time as to imagine that he had made up his mind to the worst, and could receive it with stoical calmness. Only, he did want very much to know where Leonor was, and how she was feeling, and Gollum and Marie, were they safe, and did they know where he was? Ah, it was of no use to affect indifference, The bowed head and locked hands told a different tale when he was alone. The day came and the time for the trial. Henry was summoned roughly about noon and conveyed a short way down the street to the council room where the judge for that province was then sitting. It was a large, poorly furnished room. The judge, a gentle-looking old man with white hair, sat at a table at the further end, and with a clerk writing at a smaller table just beside him. As he entered the room, his eyes fell on Leonore. As she had just been brought in and was already undergoing her examination. Henry, as he listened, was astonished by the readiness and ingenuity of her answers. She gave her real name and rank, and told them what was the truth, that she was flying from her relatives who were Roman Catholics. She allowed it to appear that she was traveling alone with her page, as she called Henry, and threatened them in no very gentle terms with the vengeance of her powerful relatives if she were not treated in a befitting manner or bestowed anywhere but with them. The judge knew well enough that if her tale were true, it was the only course open to him to pursue, and that his wisest plan was to treat her with all respect until her relatives could be communicated with. He therefore ordered that she should be removed to a convent, and that the nuns should have charge of her until orders arrived from M. de Villeneuve. He then beckoned Henry to approach and proceeded to interrogate him. The lad, mindful of his part, answered not a word for some time, but stared blankly at the judge. Suddenly, as sometimes will happen even on the most serious occasion, a keen sense of the ludicrous side of his position struck him, and it was with the greatest difficulty that he restrained himself from a burst of laughter. The truth was, he was thoroughly unhinged. He felt as if he were in a dream. The judge's voice sounded far off, and yet he noticed everything, even to the motes in the sunbeam which came in from the window high above and shone on Leonore's tawny hair as she stood a little aside with her attendants, endeavoring with tolerable success to conceal how anxious she was about Henry's examination. He knew how important it was, how the least suspicion of his sanity might be fatal to him now, and yet he felt as if he were losing all control over himself. At length the idea struck him that being such an insane thing to do, it might not matter whether he gave way or not so long as he laughed foolishly. He had not the least idea what the judge was saying by this time. The room felt as if it were turning round, when suddenly he startled them all, even Leonore for a moment, by a loud and prolonged burst of laughter. The judge spoke to him angrily. He knew that, but only laughed the more. He became conscious that the judge was looking thoroughly puzzled, that Leonore spoke sharply of the folly of wasting time on an idiot who had but one idea, to do as she bade him, and then he saw an evil-looking man stoop down to the judge and say in a low, distinct tone, evidently meant for him to hear, "Try what the torture-room will do, monsieur." His senses were all alive in a moment, and he had almost stopped laughing. If he had, it would have been fatal. But the pause was only momentary, and the next instant he saw the trap and laughed the louder. The man looked baffled, and yet not wholly satisfied. He was about to make some other suggestion when Leonore broke in again. "Comment, monsieur. Is the Comtesse Villeneuve to be kept waiting here all day? When you have quite satisfied yourself that there is no more sense than heresy in my poor lad there, perhaps you will allow us to withdraw to this convent of yours, where I trust I may be able to support life until my kinsman appears." "It is impossible that Mademoiselle can retain the services of her page in the convent," answered the judge testily. "He must be confined separately." "And why so?" demanded Leonor with well-affected indignation and surprise. "Have you found him guilty of heresy? If I may not keep my own attendant in the convent because, forsooth, your nuns cannot suffer even the semblance of a lad, he shall go and bring me my own woman from Villeneuve."
"If the lad is an idiot, he can scarce be trusted with a message," observed the dark man, who stood at the judge's elbow. His eyes were fixed on Henry, who, though his heart beat loudly with suspense, affected to be indifferently counting his buttons. "Does not even a dog know its master?" retorted Leonor in a tone of contempt. "If I give him a token and say but the name, you shall see he will bring me my woman quicker than any of your gendarmes can do it were the dragoons at their heels." This speech provoked a grim smile from most of the audience, and then there was a pause while the judge, the dark man, and the clerk conferred together in low, brief sentences. At length, apparently against the opinion of one of them, but seconded by the man who acted as clerk, the judge turned round and signified that the request might be granted, but that the message must be given, and the lad dispatched at once in his presence. "The sooner the better," answered Leonor indifferently. "I will send her something from my person, as she will understand the more quickly." She unfastened a silken handkerchief from her neck as she spoke and held it out toward the judge. "Perhaps Monsieur will like to see for himself that there is no dark heretical scheme concealed in it," she added, with a curl of scorn on her handsome lip. The dark man took the handkerchief from her hand and gravely examined every part of it. Having apparently satisfied himself, he suddenly handed it out to Henry with the words, "There, go and be thankful that you have got off so easily." Henry was ready-witted enough to stare vacantly at the handkerchief without offering to take it. Leonor burst into a mocking laugh. "It is a good animal, you see. Give me the handkerchief and rest content." The man, still narrowly watching them both, handed the handkerchief back to Leonor, who approached Henry and placed it in his hand. "Écoutez," she said slowly and deliberately, looking straight into his eyes. "Take it to Madame Bernard Villeneuve." She repeated the name twice, and Henry nodded several times with every sign of comprehension. He then placed the handkerchief in his bosom with a reverent care, which was hardly exaggerated, bowed very low, and turned to leave the room as if unconscious of everything but his message. His quick, assured movement took them by surprise. No one attempted to stop him, and the gendarmes in charge of the door looked inquiringly at the judge as Henry approached. "Yes, let him go," said the judge, and the door was opened. But Leonor noticed with alarm that at a sign from the dark man, one of the gendarmes slipped out also and followed him. But Henry was quick enough to notice this himself, and acted upon this his instant resolution. He set off at a quick, regular trot down the street in the direction in which they had come that morning, repeating aloud as he ran, "Villeneuve, Villeneuve, Villeneuve." He had not gone in this way very long before he became aware that the man who had at first followed him briskly was falling behind. Evidently, he did not see the fun of chasing an idiot boy out of the town under such a broiling sun, and his footsteps soon ceased altogether. Henry, on hearing this, gradually slackened his pace, and when he had got quite out of the town again, and felt certain that no one was in sight, he ventured to stop altogether, and flung himself for a few minutes on the grass beneath the hedge. After making quite sure that he was not observed in any way, he drew out the handkerchief with which Leonor had given him, expecting that at the last minute she would have managed to slip something into its folds. Nor was he mistaken, for he found a scrap of cambric,
evidently torn off beforehand for some portion of from some portion of her attire, on which in faint red characters, as if they had been written with the point of a pin dipped in blood, he read these words: "Adieu, mon ami. Forgive me and leave at once. You can do nothing more for me. I am safe. Thank you forever. Adieu." It took him some time to make this out, and he thought with a pang of what it must have cost her to write it. He was still reading it over when he heard footsteps on the road, and instinctively he sprung over a low wall and concealed himself till the traveler had passed. Hiding there, he began to consider seriously what to do next. To find Guillaume and Marie and consult them. Good. But how? Clearly, they would not be anywhere on this side of the town. Probably they were trying to discover his whereabouts within it. He knew it would be madness for him to venture back into the streets again. There were too many to recognize him. At this moment he heard fresh footsteps on the road, coming this time toward the town instead of away from it. He cowered still lower behind the wall, and listened as they drew near. Hark! There was one whistling. It was the tune of the Soldiers of the Cross. Forgetting all prudence in the instant conviction, Henry sprung out into the road again, and the next instant was clasped in Marie's arms. A torrent of eager questions followed, and somewhat incoherent rapture on the part of all three. Then, recollecting the danger he still ran, Henry drew them aside from the road, and they made their way to a small thicket, lying at a little distance within the field, where Henry narrated his adventures. He learned in return that Guillaume and Marie had been hanging about the prison at Port Saint-Marie almost the whole of last night, without being able to discover any news, and it was only this morning that they accidentally discovered that both the prisoners had been taken yesterday to Marmande for judgment. They had set out at once, intending to discover them by the same means, and it was just on nearing the town that Guillaume began to whistle the tune which had produced Henry before them, as it were by magic. They agreed that Henry should remain concealed where he was, and Marie with him, while Guillaume should go cautiously into the town, buy some food of which they all stood in need, and if possible learn the whereabouts of the convent in which Leonore was confined. Guillaume accordingly departed, and Henry and Marie spent the time of his absence in devising impossible means of rescuing Leonore, but could not help a conviction that after all they were impracticable. It was late in the afternoon when Guillaume came back, and he brought but little encouragement. He had found out where the convent was, but could not find any way of approach to it, as it was shut in on all sides with high walls in the midst of the town. His idea was that they should all sleep, if possible, for the next 2 or 3 hours, and then Henry and Marie should make a circuit of the town and wait for him on the other side, while he went through by the convent again and made another attempt to communicate with Leonore under cover of the night. Then he would join them in the morning, and they would be able to get away before there was any fresh stir. "And leave Leonore?" exclaimed Marie. Guillaume was silent. "What can we do?" said Henry in a low tone full of pain. "There seems no chance of rescuing her again, and if we delay, we run the risk of being taken ourselves without being able to help or even to see her." "Oh," cried Marie with a gesture of despair, "shall we ever be sure of each other again? After all the rest, first Louis, and now Leonore." Henry hid his face. Guillaume, after a few minutes' silence, whistled slowly the chorus of the Soldiers de St. Croix. "You must whistle that tonight, Guillaume," said Marie, looking up and trying to speak calmly again, And now you and Henry must lie down and go to sleep. I could not sleep just now if I were to try, so I will wake you by and by, lest we should not have time." After a little persuasion, the boys consented to do so, and Marie agreed to wake them after it had been quite dark, about an hour. They fell asleep almost directly, and Marie sat between them, and with her back against a tree, watching the sunlight slant more and more between the branches, till at length it seemed to strike upward instead of down. Then it sunk altogether, and a pale red hush spread itself over the sky and faded away. It grew dusk, and Marie wondered how long they had been sitting there. She began to feel very drowsy and had to pinch herself to keep awake. She looked at the boys. There was still light enough to see their faces. They were sleeping soundly. She was struck by the little difference that they showed, now that they were both asleep. Gloom was nearly as tall as Henry, and their features were very similar, but in expression and coloring they differed entirely. Henry's frank, open face was like his father's, as his brown hair and eyes. In Gloom's dreamy reserve and pale, almost sallow complexion, he was like no one else in the family except perhaps Father Gabriel. His hair was as black as Marie's, but he had a magnificent pair of gray eyes under their heavy fringe of black eyelashes. Marie thought of her little Louis, so different from these two and lately so like Aurella. She wondered what he was doing now, and pulled herself up with a start just as she was falling asleep again. It was quite dark now, and Marie began to wonder how she should know when an hour had passed. In fact, she was so afraid of letting them oversleep themselves, and the time seemed so long that she waked them in reality scarcely half an hour afterwards, but they were quite ready for the night's work. Henry and Marie set off to walk around the town, and Gloom crossed the field into the high road by himself. There was none about, and very little stir even in the town when he approached it. Some of the houses had already shut up for the night, but in the principal street there was a good deal going on, as in fact it was scarcely 10 o'clock by the time Gloom reached the town. He soon found that it was too early to do much near the convent, and so he withdrew into the quieter streets and sat down by the riverside for some time, watching the moon rise over the houses. At length he became aware that everything had grown still around him, and that the whole town had gone to sleep. He rose from his seat and walked away toward the convent, which was at no great distance. Its high dark walls and general outline reminded him very much of the one from which they had taken Leonore, but this one was surrounded by an outer wall about 20 feet high, and the convent itself stood some way back within it. A narrow, dark alley led round the wall from the street to the back of the convent. Gloom went down this and came out in a quiet, open space covered with short grass, evidently the drying ground of the convent. The moonlight now made everything clearly visible, and he thought perhaps it might be possible to climb up on the wall by means of one of the buttresses with which it was strengthened here and there. With great difficulty and many falls, he succeeded at last in getting sufficiently high to look over the wall. On the other side also it went down straight for 20 feet to a stony gravel path. There were no trees anywhere along the whole line of wall by which he might have obtained a hold. The convent here advanced nearer to the wall than in front, and a long line of windows fronted him not 30 feet from where he clung. There was no sign of life about the place. All was dark and silent. After a minute or two, Gloom began softly to whistle the Soldiers to St. Croix, and paused in the middle. There was no answer, except that he fancied something stirred in one of the rooms just opposite, and after waiting some time and feeling that he could not hold on much longer, he began again.
This time a window opposite to him was slowly and noiselessly opened, and a white figure showed itself for an instant. Gloom held his breath and bent his head out of sight for a moment to consider whether he was safe or not. As he stooped, he heard the tune continued, very faintly, but still a continuation and not an echo. He looked up, and there, leaning out into the moonlight, he saw Leonore. She was kneeling on the sill, with her long, gleaming hair falling all around her, and even at that distance Gloom could see how her eyes shone. They did not dare to speak to each other. They were not near enough for that. But she kissed her hand to him once, and then waved to him to go away. Gloom answered by a gesture as if to leap down inside the wall, but her horrified signs reminded him the next moment of the extreme folly and uselessness of such a proceeding. She still urgently signed to him to go, and he felt that his feet were slipping. He held up something and made signs that he wanted to throw it in. It was only a fold of paper on which they had written a farewell letter that afternoon, earnestly hoping against hope that they might not need to send it, and contained a little gold cross, which she would know for Marie's, and two locks of short hair cut from the boys' heads. Leonore moved aside a moment from the narrow window, and he threw it straight into the little cell. Then she leant out again for a moment. And so he saw her for the last time, with the light on her tawny hair and her softened, yearning face. Then his feet slipped again, and he half fell, half slipped to the ground, and so went sorrowfully away to join his brother and sister on their weary journey again.